Welcome to Processing Distortion, the podcast series here at BoilingFrogsPost.com. I'm your host, Peter B. Collins. And today I'm delighted to welcome back to our program the editor, publisher, founder of BoilingFrogsPost.com, Sibel Edmonds. Sibel, as always, great to be with you.
Thank you, Peter, and likewise.
And welcome back from your summer adventure. We did not disclose your travel destinations while you were away, but you got to go back to Turkey for the first time since you were gagged over 10 years ago.
That's correct. In fact, this is the first time I have been in that particular region since February of 2000. That was when my father passed away. And then immediately after that, this whole shenanigan and the issues took place with the FBI. So it has been 15 years,
wow.
15 plus years.
Well, I just feel good for you to be able to go back and connect with family and friends. And I know you're doing a lot of research in the region. I asked you before we started recording, and I'm happy to hear that you didn't have any incidents with the U.S. Global security apparatus.
That's correct. Thankfully, I had no incidents. We had some tough times in certain regions due to the, you know, the terror events or the chaos and also temperatures, because we were in this particular region where you reached regularly 105, 110 degrees with no air conditions anywhere, but nothing politically. And we were in the region within 150 miles of where that terrorist attack took place with this female suicide bomber that happened to kill 34 people and injure hundreds of people in that area. So we were right there. But no, you're right. And we were relieved that nothing bad happened on that front.
Yeah. Now, I did receive an email from you, and without identifying you, I shared with my listeners that you were in the vicinity of Suruk about 3 weeks ago when the event that you just referred to occurred. And you tipped off that, your observations indicated that this very well could be a false flag, a contrived event. And working with that hypothesis and seeing how it has been used as the trigger for Turkey's new muscular involvement in the U.S.-led coalition against Daesh, and that Turkey has used this in a pretextual way for a massive military crackdown on the Kurds who reside in Turkey, their indigenous Kurdish population. So tell us a little bit about the event and what observations you have that it might have been staged and the political events and decisions that have flowed from it.
Oh, absolutely. Even though what I'm going to talk about was never touched upon here in the United States with the media, alternative and mainstream alike, starting from about a couple of weeks before this terror event, certain newspapers actually talked about the fact that the Turkish intelligence agency had received or had in its possession this information that there were going to be some female suicide bombers with specific regions, and that it was going to take place within the next couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. And maybe this was some sort of inadvertent leak coming from some person within the Turkish intelligence agencies, but actually this whole warning was published at least a week to 10 days before the event took place. Mm. So that itself, the fact that there was specific information that the event in this region by female suicide bomber was going to take place, was out there floating. Then on the day of the event, even within hours of the event, that whole area where the casualties took place was cordoned off by dozens of police officers, both special forces and police officers, which they had no reason to be there. Ordinarily, considering the targets who were killed, and these were the socialists, Marxist socialist group in Turkey, you would expect maybe two or three informants or the civilian clothed, you know, officers being there. But to be cordoned off by police officers in dozens and special forces, that itself was very, very unusual. And the third thing was, and this I got it from a couple of sources who were covering the event afterwards there, media sources, etc. And they said that several eyewitnesses were rounded up as soon as this took place. And they were taken in, they were detained, and some of them, they refrained from providing any eyewitness accounts, and the other two, basically they gave the same line that was provided. Again, why would you detain eyewitnesses? Now, some people can explain it away by saying maybe they wanted to clear them, make sure they didn't have any contacts or connections to the suicide bomber, etc. But that itself was unusual. And of course, as you said, with consequent events following that terror incident, the escalation and the direct bombing, which happened within 48 hours of northern Syria region, that also makes it suspicious. And of course, maybe we'll get into that because it's relevant. Through a source, insider, military source there, I was told that special preparation began towards end of April along the border by Turkish military for the final stage of war or operation against Syria. And the military, including their medics and all the tents that they started setting up there, they were given 6-month timeline for the final stage, the final phase of the operations against Syria, meaning war. Mm-hmm. And so if you calculate that from mid-April, you're looking into end of October for it to end. And the fact that it was going to be triggered by, again, some internal events and terror events. So when you put all these ingredients, it makes the whole thing, situation, the event kind of suspicious. I would even say highly suspicious. Now, having said that, I spoke to people who were actually not really defending Erdogan's position in this, but people who were providing counter argument that, in fact, this was a false flag event set up by the not the deep state, but by the government itself. And what they told me actually made sense as well. I mean, the fact that it was probably a false flag operation set up, that stands, it's true. But the question remains about whose decision, whose operation was that? Mm-hmm. Are we talking about deep state US, which is, of course, part of the Operation Gladio B? Are we looking at the oppositions within Turkey that have their own networks within the military? Or are we looking at the formal official administration, Erdogan's administration? The question becomes, who executed this? Mm-hmm. See, their reasoning that I was provided with said, Erdogan has been placed in this really, really, really tough position. His party didn't get the majority, okay?
Right.
That's number one. Number two, it is the economic situation in Turkey works being kind of really in a volatile situation presents the biggest risk to his party and to Erdogan. One of the major factors for Erdogan's administration to remain in power for 12, 13 years, which is unheard of for any single party to have a majority like that for that amount of time. Just like anywhere else in Europe, you have a bunch of coalitions, then one goes, 2 years later, you have different coalitions. One of the main reasons for it has been this Turkey's economic stand, which has been really, even with bubbles and everything, in good shape, let's say compared to when we had the crash here in the United States, when Europe has been falling economically, you know, the situation with Spain and Greece, for Turkey being standing so strong economically, has gone a long way in sustaining the current administration. Now, without having the majority, On top of it, when they are talking about coalitions and early elections, if economically you get this domino effect and Turkey goes down, then you are truly guaranteeing the end of Erdogan's government. You are guaranteeing for AKP to lose its complete power because people are reactionary, Peter. So when their stomachs are fed and they have their housing, everything is good, they are less likely to go and want to have a different government. But once you take that away and economy gets bad, then you get more people saying, I've had it with this government, I don't want this government. Well, this situation with Turkey, with this terror incident, it really hurts, and it hurt greatly Turkey's economy. Number one, Turkey's tourism sector is huge, huge. It's like, I would say, second or the third largest sector in Turkey. The income revenue is tourism. When this took place, you had all these tourists canceled from Europe, from United States, from everywhere. So these hotels, these resorts, all these car rental places, economy greatly suffered and it still is suffering because now Turkey has become a volatile region where tourists, they don't want to go. Number two, what we get is when you get situations like that and with the unclear government's political stability, with the coalition, lack of coalition, the stock market comes down, which it did after these events. So when you sum up all these things, the consequences, you would see who really would get hurt the most politically in Turkey. It would be Erdogan and Erdogan's party, AKP. So they said for him, it would be shooting himself on the foot. Granted, on Syria front, he would want this. But politically, especially during this volatile situation, it would hurt him. Why would he do or go along with doing something like that when it's him and his party who would be paying the ultimate price, especially with what's happening in? So what I'm trying to say here is they are all these different theories. And when I heard this line of reasoning, I had to pause and say, well, yeah, that makes sense, right? It does make sense. So because of that, I am not putting a really conclusive ink on this whole event. Was it a false flag operation? I would say probably, highly likely that yes, it was, because the timing, etc. Now, who were the ultimate decision makers in creating this? That is a little bit of a question mark. And you don't know how much is Erdogan versus how much independently Turkish military, which is still under the U.S. Directive.
Sibel, one thing that strikes me, and I'm interested in your reaction, is that Erdogan is pulling a page from the playbook of his arch rival, Bibi Netanyahu, who, in advance of his re-election this year, pounded the Palestinians in Gaza for 51 days last summer. And it brings up all the nativist emotions and political momentum. And it appears to me that this is a pretty calculated plan, as you describe it, with the six-month timeline for Erdogan to pummel the Kurds under the guise of participating in the international coalition against the Islamic State for saving his own ass.
I would say, that's possible. But it's the ingredients that goes into the actual fact situation is so numerous that it is so hard to again put a conclusive conclusion into that, because yes, on one hand that's the case, but again, who does it benefit the most, pounding on the Kurds? Because in the past, he draw major support from various Kurdish factions within Turkey for his majority. Of course, that has changed, and in fact, they are now in the opposition camp. And pounding on them, I just don't know how it can have him score high generally in Turkey. And then the other thing is the relationship between Erdogan and U.S. during this entire period. It keeps going back and forth and back and forth, everything hinging upon, as you just said, Kurdish issue. Because U.S. and Erdogan's administration and Turkey, they have this thing that, yes, we want to pound, we want to get rid of Assad, we want basically the whole goal that has been in place since 2011. This was when U.S. Operation Gladio, NATO began training the same people we are talking about here, ISIS, in Turkey, in southern Turkey, in U.S. Air Force Base in Incirlik. They were bringing in people, training them, arming them, and funneling them back to destabilize Assad's regime and to cause all this stuff. Well, you're looking at the same as ISIS, okay? 99, 95, 93, just put a percentage, but the large majority of the people we are tagging as ISIS were the ones that we trained and we put in place there. So everything has been on the same page except this big rift on the Kurdish because U.S. and U.S. forces, Western forces, have also been working with various Kurdish factions in the region. And that has been fruitful for the Western interests. And in the scheme of working closely with Turkey doing that, the cost for U.S. and Western military would be basically isolating and giving up Kurds and actually put the Kurds in the opposition front instead of allies. And there's no way U.S. and the Western countries can afford that. Yet there's no way they can afford doing something jointly with Turkey without that consequence. So there is this really dilemma out there that puts the brake on everything, because without that, this operation would have ended after that terror event.
I'm sorry, the Kurds in both Syria and Iraq are the only fighters that the U.S. Can have any reliance on. The Iraqis are useless, and that's pretty clear. The myth of these moderate Syrians, the so-called Division 30, that we've trained up at the cost of $4 million a man, and they're crumbling. They have taken a pledge not to fight the Nusra Front because Nusra kidnapped their leader. And so this is just a complete mess, where the U.S. appears to be now willing to trade both the PKK and the YPP, these two Kurdish fighting groups, the Peshmerga. They're willing to basically consign them to slaughter at the hands of Turkish fighter jets in order to try to get Turkey to put troops on the ground and to clear this this space at the northern border with Syria. And this just seems to be another irrational plan by the United States, where Obama is desperately lurching from pillar to post, trying to find a way that at least presents the illusion that the U.S. is winning or gaining ground.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you emphasized the word illusion. And it's important to note here that both with the Kurds and the ISIS, the enemy that U.S. has been bombing and everything that we hear or we read about here in the U.S. is absolutely wrong. It's not against any ISIS. In fact, all the offensives, the casualties have been heavily Assad's, pro-Assad's factions, including the Assad government, members of military and the pro-Assad people, and that what they are creating here in the United States with the mainstream media, that the bombing took place or this fight took place and they killed 100 ISIS, and this is based on people who go in and out of Syria that I spoke with, is absolutely false. Same thing with the coalition they have, the United States with the Kurds, it is against Assad's regime and the Assad's military and all the faction who still support Assad. And none of this is true that we are, or our forces together with the Kurds or with Turks, that we are killing ISIS people. It's absolutely wrong. In fact, another piece of information I got from several sources, including people who drive supplies trucks from in and out of Syria, is that there is a large presence of British special forces on the ground in northern Syria who are dressed as ISIS, blue-eyed, green-eyed, speaking with heavily British-accented English, and they're there.
Yeah.
So that's another big thing that you never really hear U.S. mainstream media or alternative, pseudo-alternative covering, or they twist it and they talk about ISIS recruiting these people, converting them, brainwashing them, and funneling them as fighters, which is absolutely baloney.
Yeah. No, so much of this stuff is like at a carnival, a hall of mirrors. Where,
yes.
You know, you go in and at one point you see your own reflection and then it's distorted. And then you see something in your peripheral vision that's coming from somewhere else. Sibel, as we look at this right now, I'm curious if people in the region expect a major deployment of American troops at some point over the next 9 to 12 months. Because General Ray Odierno, who is retiring as Army Chief of Staff, he was running the war in Iraq before, he is dropping some heavy hints in weasel word language, but still it appears that he's trying to pave the way for a political agreement to deploy U.S. troops there. And I would like to get your impressions of what people in the region believe, and if Turkey is expecting U.S. troop deployments to match some of its own, if that in fact occurs.
Well, currently you do have a fairly decent number of special forces, and not only that, you also have these missionaries in the region who are in the region, southern Turkey, in northern Iraq, in northern Syria. As far as the U.S. deploying large number of forces, troops there, that is one of the I would say offering Turkey has already made formally to U.S. saying, we would allow you to bring in your forces. Forget about just the Incirlik base, the U.S. base in Turkey. We will make available 4 other bases to you along the region, which covers basically the entire southern border of Turkey. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So that's the nugget. That's the sweetener that Turkey has been offering to U.S. saying, look, we'll give you the right to come, bring in the troops. We let you use 4 additional bases in Turkey in addition to your own base, only if you let us give us a free hand, so we would do whatever we want to do with the Kurds, and you basically dissolve this partnership you have with the Kurds.
Mm-hmm.
That is the question that we are going to see whether it's going to be answered or not. From what I've read when I was there, the position of White House Obama, they're willing to give up Kurds. And most people in State Department is pro-Turkey, what Turkey wants. On the other hand, from, again, what I have heard and read there, it has been Pentagon that has been rejecting that scenario. They are saying the price is too high. Yeah, we can bring the forces, we can use all the bases, but abandoning our Kurdish allies, it will prove in the long term far more disastrous, because you're not only looking at northern Syria, but you're also looking at northern Iraq. And especially with Iraq, that won't be the case. And the other thing I was going to quickly mention, which I forgot, I think, to mention it at the beginning, and this was, again, with people who were present in Mosul in June 2014, when the Mosul, the region, fell.
Mm-hmm.
Well, contrary to what was reported here in the United States, the media, there were no fightings. There were zero battles. In fact, within a week before this takeover, they were told, and this is the Iraqi military, to put down their arms, to show zero resistance. And the special forces, both U.S. and British, they were on the ground and making sure they were de-arming, taking arms away. In fact, when ISIS took over, it was like it was like a mayors and all the people coming and greeting ISIS. There were no gunshots being fired. There was no explosion and there was no fighting. And the whole thing was staged differently here. But that was, again, a calculated made event there of this so-called ISIS takeover of Mosul, which is immensely interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. I want to mention that Sibel also did an interview with James Corbett, the eye-opener, and you can find it at boilingfrogspost.com if you haven't seen it already. And there was an eye-opener in there for me, Sibel, as you referred to the Israeli base in northern Iraq near Mosul. And this is something that I was unaware of, and, you know, I try to pay close attention to these things. So talk a little bit about the history of this Israeli installation and what its current role might be.
Yeah, believe me or not, Peter, the story and which is fact, which is 100% confirmed as far as the rest of the world goes, except for maybe U.S. and in U.K. probably, it's at least 12 years old. In 2003-2004, Israel, they formed this alliance with the Kurds, certain factions, powerful factions of Kurdish people in northern Iraq, to come and put bases, Israeli bases in northern Iraq, right along the border with Iran, okay? In return, the Israelis promised these Kurdish factions that they would train them militarily, very savvy training, arm them, okay? And in return for using that whole region for their bases, okay? So this was formed, this was put in place. And of course, Turkey has a very good intelligence gathering power in the region. So Turks went banana. I mean, they went nuts when they found out about this from the beginning stage. And first they started complaining to US and saying, this is unacceptable because, as you know, because of the friction between the Turks and the Kurds, and this would also give this both arms and training to the Kurds in the region, which for Turkey is a major no-no being in northern Iraq. Well, U.S. basically remained silent. They didn't do anything. So Turks in 2004-2005, they took it upon themselves to organize their own operations, intelligence gathering operation in the region. So they sent some high-level operatives, including high-level military, both military intelligence and MIT, into northern Iraq. That's when the incident took place, if you remember, Peter. This was when we just read in all the headlines that U.S. military went and arrested and detained some high-level Turkish military people, personnel, in northern Iraq, and they put these bags over their head. They took them to jail. They kept them for 4 or 5 days, and U.S. was forced to apologize later. Well, they never told the whole story. The whole story was the people that U.S. actually went and put bags over their heads and detained, these high-level Turkish military and intelligence operatives, were there because of this Israeli bases for that purpose. So in that case, U.S. actually went and protected Israel and their base in northern Iraq by arresting and detaining these Turkish counterforce to what was happening there. So during this stage, the two high-level Turkish generals, they took all their pictures that they had gathered from the Israeli bases in northern Iraq, all the documentation through their informants, etc. They bundled this, and they contacted their man here in U.S., who is Seymour Hersh. So Seymour Hersh flew to Turkey. He was there for 3 days. In fact, at the time, I was in Alexandria, and that was when I used to see Seymour Hersh. He met with these generals. He was given these documents, including aerial pictures, informants, everything. And for years and years, Seymour Hersh has been using these top generals as his sources in other stuff. So they have had really ongoing relationship for dozens of years, Seymour Hersh and these top Turkish generals. He comes and he basically kills the story. He doesn't do anything about that part that has to do with Israeli bases, etc. And that, again, really, really, really turned up the certain factions within Turkish intelligence and Turkish military. And then they made that movie, The Valley of Wolf, Valley mm-hmm. of the Wolves, yeah. And which is based on that whole event, which is before my book, before my statements, to a small degree is exposing Operation Gladio B. So even though it is by the right-wing Turks, okay, the right-wing Turks as far as military right-wing Turks, because there are different factions. There are right-wings in different categories, and this is the one pro-military, includes these generals. And that's how it was financed. That's how the movie was made. But of course, we only got some kind of a headline saying, and nobody ever delved into why. How in the world U.S. military personnel goes there, puts bags on the heads of these lieutenant generals, these Turkish allies, NATO allies, and they detain them. Nobody ever got into that whole why aspects of it. Everybody in Iraq knows. Everybody in Turkey knows. Everybody in Israel knows. But it was completely quashed, and the first person who was given everything to, of course, was Simon Hirsch.
Fascinating. Really fascinating. So, Bell, I know that you transited into Turkey through some of the Greek islands. And I wonder if you could give us your impressions of the wave of refugees moving in the other direction, coming from Turkey and Syria and seeking refuge, at least a first stop in Greece. And right now we've seen pictures of thousands of people who are entrapped in a stadium in Kos because the Greeks are overwhelmed and, of course, they're broke. So it is quite a crisis, and I wonder if you could give us a snapshot.
Sure. I did not witness any of the refugees influx in Greece or elsewhere in Europe where I was. But in Turkey, you're looking at over 2 million Syrian refugees. And again, that has contributed to so many different kinds of difficulties in Turkey. One, for example, the increase in a bunch of diseases that were wiped out of Turkey. Now it's back, including polio. And the other thing is economic, because, you see them everywhere. They are right now, for example, they have the largest network of beggars in metropolitan cities. Mm-hmm. You go to some restaurant and you sit in some cafe. There are dozens and dozens of them, and some of them are actually wrapping some babies behind them, and they come and beg. And these are all Syrian refugees there. It used to be a small faction of gypsies. They call them the Turkish gypsies who would do that. But now it's only Syrian refugees. Certain neighborhoods, it's not only along the border. It's all over Turkey. Yeah. Some people that I was talking with, they were actually angry with Erdogan because they said that Erdogan has issued residence permits and work permit to many of these people, and they are willing to work for some ridiculous amount. Let's say if you are a clerk working in, let's say, some store or in a restaurant, and the minimum wage in Turkey, I'm just throwing numbers here, okay? Don't quote me on the numbers. Mm-hmm. Let's say it's $800 or $1,000, these Syrian refugees with these work residence permits, they come there and they say, I'm willing to do the same job for $150.
Sure.
So they are saying that many of the Turkish workers, especially from more lower paying jobs and things that were already being paid low wages, they have been taken out and they have been replaced by extremely low wage. I mean, $150 a month. Think about it. Mm. And Turkey right now, the living expenses have gone up tremendously. So I have heard stories about that and compounds, and the situation is dire. I would say that has also contributed greatly to the elections result in Turkey, because so many people in Turkey are very upset. They are very unhappy with Erdogan for letting this, what they call situation, escalate to this level where Turkey is paying for all the stuff in addition to all the stuff that they are doing militaristically. It's with the 2 million plus refugees there, and the situation, things are brewing. I have to say, maybe they are boiling currently in Turkey in this regard. I don't know what's going to happen with the election results this coming October. That's when they are saying the elections are going to be held, but it's not looking good for Erdogan's administration. And And another thing that is good to mention as a side note, it's not irrelevant because it's relevant, is the psychology of people, and you see them whether you're in Turkey or you're in the United States. Let's say even if Erdogan did not participate in that false flag operation with Suruç incident, what happened was immediately afterwards, all the newspapers started attacking Erdogan and saying, it's because you are a weak leader. Mm-hmm. We need to go and bomb them. We have to go and pound on them. You have to put your foot down, U.S. or no U.S. We want to go and bomb the hell. Let's go and just level the entire country, Syria. And you saw exactly the same reactions from almost every Turk. So in a way, had he not done that, he would have been taken down immediately, because that is the first psychological reaction, emotional reaction on the ground from the people, from the newspaper, from talk show hosts. And they thought that was not soon enough, that the moment that took place, Turkish military should have just gone out there and they should have just bombed the hell out of entire Syria. So you have to look at that psychological effect that these types of false flag operations achieve. And again, this brings a little bit of plausibility to the camp that said, sure, Erdogan went and bombed it, but we don't know exactly whose mastermind work it was, because with economic situation on the ground and everything, he had to go and pound because, I mean, people, you should have seen people in the screen. Erdogan, you know, have you been neutered? Erdogan, and they started putting his cartoon as a little fairy or joker saying, look, this is what's happening. They are doing it in our soil. And there were these rumors that five other female suicide bombers were lurking all over Istanbul with this already set targets that they were going to blow themselves up. You put these, you always get the same result, whether you're in the United States of America, whether you're in Turkey, whether you're in Egypt, whether you're in Iceland. This is what happens. And this is why the recipe has proven successful, the false flag events, because it results in exactly what they aim to accomplish, and that is more wars, pounding, aggression, you know, mm-hmm. detaining, torture. That's what it justifies everything by getting people fired up and actually ask for it, demand for it. Yeah, let's torture them, let's waterboard them, let's just wipe the whole race. That's exactly, whether it's Hitler or Obama or Bush or Erdogan, everybody gets the same thing from their populace when they have situations like this on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunate.
Sibel, I know you only have a couple of minutes here, but I did want to get your comment on the silence about Dennis Hastert. Hastert was the Republican Speaker of the House. He helped ram through the Patriot Act. And earlier this summer, he was indicted for structured financial transactions, which are given greater penalties under the Patriot Act. And you tell me that you were getting on the plane as the story started to break. We did share with our listeners the dispatch that you sent from abroad. But curiously, the whole story is just gone. We haven't heard a bit about the Hastert case, even about what was revealed about the young man that he allegedly had an inappropriate contact with a long time ago. But you raise very important issues about Hastert's role in covering for Turkish interests, in covering drug running into Chicago that involves Turkish operatives. And there's so much more about structured campaign contributions that went into the Hastert campaign at $99 so that the donor did not have to be disclosed. So there's a great deal that the media has suppressed about the Hastert case, and now it's just completely out of the coverage.
Absolutely. It doesn't even begin scratching the surface, Peter. And the reason they have quashed it, think about it. A story like this break, okay? Then you have Vanity Fair story that came out where I and other sources revealed all the stuff on Hastert in 2005, 2006. When you have all the interviews and everything I have given on Dennis Hastert. When you're looking at a book that I published with Hastert showing up there.
Yep.
Okay. You would think that CNN or NBC or Fox News, they will be calling to get comments, correct?
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing. Nobody wanted to touch that hot potato because They wanted to have that remain as a very small scratch of the surface, because if they were to get into that, so much more comes out, just not this particular story, but Hastert's ongoing nefarious illegal sexual activities that he was carrying out in this particular townhouse that he used downstairs for office, upstairs for bedroom. But here's the thing, and I think you and I maybe should do another session on this whole thing, Peter, because I won't be able to adjust this in 1 minute, 30 seconds that I have to go. But with Hastert, while these things were taking place, not with this particular guy, boy, that they are talking about, mm-hmm. I'm talking about things as recent and all the way up to 2001 with the sexual conducts that he had. Mm-hmm. And while he was doing that, he was being monitored and recorded by the CIA, by the FBI, and that includes the surveillance man, by a particular Turkish network group there. So you're looking at least three entities who were filming and documenting all these things for blackmail, for all the other things that he was doing. You have three different entities having all this information and much, much more on Hastert. And if this, through me, would come out on Hastert, then inevitably, you would get all the other ones coming out, because similar operations were being conducted by people like Dan Burton, Jan Tchaikovsky, and it's a can of worms that they would never, ever, ever touch, because it's a kind of a thing that would bring down the whole system and would show the public how it is quashed, how it is controlled, people in Congress, and so much more. But we will have a session on that when you get a chance, and we will talk about that, and I can get more into details of the things.
All right. Sibel, welcome back. Thank you for a great conversation today, and keep up the great work at BoilingFrogsPost.com.
Many thanks, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Processing Distortion featuring Sibel Edmonds. I welcome your feedback, comments. You can drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.